Here's a subject that I am certain we will be discussing more and more in the future. We've talked about it a bit here and there on Issues, etc. I would say after gay marriage, it will be the next big thing. Along with gay marriage, it will be part of the conversation. It already is. The subject, of course, is gay adoption. We're going to be talking about that here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Greg Rogers will join us in just a moment. That's the first part of the first hour. In the second part, we're going to be talking with Dr. James Lamb on two issues. First of all, it was either late yesterday or early today that the results of Terry Schindler Schiavo's autopsy were made public. In summary, she died of dehydration. That was to be expected. She was being dehydrated and starved to death. There was no evidence of any type of trauma prior to her brain damage. And finally, the autopsy revealed that her brain damage was profound and irreversible. Now, before you say, well, there you go, Michael Schiavo did the right thing, wait. We'll see what Dr. James Lamb has to say there in about 25 minutes. We'll also be talking with him as someone who suffers from multiple sclerosis about whether or not MS victims should support embryonic stem cell research. Dr. James Lamb of Lutherans for Life coming up in about 25 minutes. In the 4 o'clock hour, hour 2, a little bit of open lines for your questions and your comments. A question I mentioned yesterday, but we just didn't have time to get to, and that is, should the choir, should the praise band be in the front of the church? I want your answer to that question in the second hour of Issues, etc. And then in the third hour, because our audience is turning over constantly every 15, 20 minutes because we are a drive time program, our 3 o'clock listeners got to hear our last week's interview with Dr. Robert Schuller, and our 4 o'clock listeners got to hear it as well, but our 5 o'clock listeners may have missed our interview with Dr. Robert Schuller. We'll play it again there in the third hour of the program, and we'll get your reaction to it as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727 is our call-in number for all 3 hours of Issues, etc. today. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Greg Rogers is a freelance journalist. He has written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Suffer the Children, What's Wrong with Gay Adoption? And he joins us live from South Africa. Greg, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd.
Just so we know, our listeners are filled in here. What time is it and how's the weather in South Africa?
It's just after 10 o'clock at night. It's pretty dark and fairly cold. We're in the middle of our winter here.
Yes, it is winter in the Southern Hemisphere. We tend to forget that down there, especially
right.
South Africa. You were down closer to Antarctica than just about anything else, it seems.
Yes, that's right. We actually have our special, our own base, our own South African base in Antarctica. So we're pretty closely linked there.
Greg, someone looks at the issue of adoption in general and they say, look, the less orphans, the better. The more children with any kind of family, the better. And if gay adoption is one way to get children out of orphanages, out of foster homes, then let's do it. How do you respond to that, Greg?
I think there are a number of ways we could have a look at that. First of all, I think we've got to consider that adoption doesn't necessarily solve all ills. In other words, there are cases in which the lesser of two evils is, in fact, for the child to have no parent. There exists a very real possibility that gay parenthood may, in fact, add to and not detract from the angst of the orphan. For example, I've got a quote here from Lynn Wardle. Lynn Wardle is a professor of law in Utah. And he claims that the assertion that same-sex couples can and do provide nurturing parenting misses the point. Polygamous parents, incestuous parents, and immature adolescents can and do provide nurturing parenting also. For that matter, child molesters, child beaters, and child murderers can and do sometimes provide safe and adequate parenting for some children. But society's view of the welfare and interests of society and of children leads us to draw conclusions from the overall general picture, not from the exceptions. In other words, society based its laws not on the exceptions to the rule, but to the rule itself.
Greg, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say I've got quite a lot of data here, which I put in the article, and other data besides that, which I could read out, which in the course of the program, which would indicate the very tremendous problems anxiety-related problems that exist in the gay subculture and promiscuity problems as well, which raise very serious questions as to the whole area of gay adoption.
We'll get to the specifics here in just a moment, but more generally, before we go into the specifics of gay relationships and how they bear upon the issue of gay adoption, how did we get to the point where gay adoption is now not only something that, say, a few activist groups in the West are trying to push for, but in fact now being considered to varying degrees, say, here in the United States, as the next step in adoption law? How did we get to this point?
I think one can look at that on a number of different levels. Apart from the general history, there's a psychological level, a sociological level. I think political correctness has got a lot to do with this. Now, the interesting thing is that political correctness, if you trace its roots back, is ultimately based on Marxism, in that it claims a sort of absolute equality, which sounds good and well. Democracy also claims absolute equality. Sure, all human beings are equal before God. But Marxism goes one step further, and that it tries to dissolve, for example, basic patriarchal structures in the family and in society. One thing Karl Marx was doing was trying to dissolve the family structure, to try to dissolve male headship, to dilute that particular strength in society so that he'd be able to obviously to infiltrate and subvert more and more societies. And if we look, for example, at the feminists, the early feminists in the early 20th century, we see that they were essentially Marxists. And basically they based a lot of their theorizing on that. And today we've got this very, what some would call a democratic aspect to our society, which we're sure all people are equal. That's democracy. That's the Bible. But Marxism goes that one step further and says, yes, we're not only equal in that sort of mystical way in which we reflect the image of God, but we're equal in all sorts of other biological ways which just don't tie up when we consider what nature's all about. And we've got a lot of teaching in universities, for example, at the moment, where biology is being redefined, and where people are saying there's no realistic biological difference between, or there's no ultimate biological difference between male and female. And that of course is feminist dogma, but it works into gay dogma as well, where the male headship, male patriarchy is being eroded more and more, and that's something based on the Bible. And as I said in the article, society is based on marriage. It's based on the two-point family, and if marriage falls, society falls with it. And to cut a long story short, I think it's very interesting that we think Marxism is dead, but Marxism has actually eroded significantly into the structure of society through feminist rights and through gay rights. And I think a lot of that has got to do with Western guilt about colonialism, about racism, and in other words, we've got a number of groups in society who very justifiably are claiming for rights. They have been victimized in the past, and we as Christians have to see that their needs are met and that their claims are met as regards righting past wrongs. Unfortunately, we've got other groups who are jumping onto that same bandwagon who have no reason to be on that bandwagon. And I think because of the tremendous Western guilt that we're feeling at the moment, that has actually allowed a lot of political correctness, where we've got gay groups, for example, who all they've got to do is claim that an oppressed minority, and they jump on the same bandwagon as people who are genuinely oppressed minority groups. And I don't think claiming that one has been oppressed or marginalized by society for some reason necessarily means that your claims can be met. But I think that the essential ethos in society that is being manipulated is the ethos of guilt. There's a lot of racial guilt and a lot of colonial guilt and Western guilt, and I think that's responsible for a lot of the political correctness. People don't want to complain about anybody who claims to be an oppressed minority in case you're called a bigot or a fundamentalist or what have you. So I think that's got a lot to do with it as well.
Let's talk about some of the data that you've assembled for your article in the Christian Research Journal, Suffer the Children, What's Wrong with Gay Adoption, beginning
right.
with what research would tell us about individual gays, and perhaps we could deal with the issue of their personal relationships as gays and lesbians, in particular the promiscuity.
Sure. Yes, yes. You know, we have significant question marks that can be raised over the stability of gay relationships. Of course, gay marriage activists claim that gay marriages are, or at least gay relationships are stable and there's no problem. But the stats say something different. In fact, many of the stats are taken from gay writings and from studies conducted by gay psychologists. I've got a couple here. The first is a very famous study by two researchers called Bell and Weinberg, and they did this through the Kinsey Institute, which is traditionally regarded as quite a liberal institute. And 9% of their gay respondents to the survey stated that they had had between 50 and 99 sexual partners in the course of their lives. And 28% admitted to having had 1,000 or more sexual partners throughout their lives, of which 79% admitted that more than half of their partners had been strangers. There's another very big study it came out in a book called The Gay Report, and that's written by two gay activists, Allen and Young. And in that particular study, 35% admitted to having had 100 or more sexual partners, 59% admitted to having taken part in orgies or group sex. I've got yet another quote also from two gay writers, Kirk and Madsen, and about 15 years ago they wrote a book called After the Ball, where they made the statement that the cheating ratio of inverted commas married gay males, given enough time, approximates 100%. Many gay lovers, bowing to the inevitable, agree to an open relationship for which there are as many sets of ground rules as there are couples. And to make it even worse, Andrew Sullivan, who's one of the leading gay marriage activists in the world, basically tries to vindicate promiscuity, where he says that same-sex unions often incorporate the virtues of friendship more effectively than traditional marriages because of the openness of the contract and because of the great understanding of the need for extramarital outlets. And he actually claims that heterosexual marriages can learn from such marital infidelity. Now, another interesting statement I want to go through. The American Academy of Religion, of course, they have the annual conference. Now, the American Academy of Religion is the official the largest body of religious groups and theologians in the States, in America, and in their 2004 annual meeting, a body that is formed under that comes under the American Academy of Religion, the Gay Men's Issues in Religion group, they gave a series of talks at the AAR, the American Academy of Religion's annual meeting, and in the 2004 meeting, gay theologians, a whole series of them, related how they felt the Bible helped them understand gay's sadomasochistic experience, and amazingly, they were allowed to give another talk in 2005, another series of talks where this time their topic was challenging monogamy and basically relating how the Bible helps them understand the concept of multiple partners. Now, we've got to raise enormous questions here because these are supposedly gay theologians, and if gay theologians who people who claim to be gay Christians are actually encouraging infidelity and encouraging all the sort of sexual practices, then, how can society grant their children to this sort of subculture where there appears to be very little real desire to remain faithful and represent a stable family?
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking with Greg Rogers about gay adoption. He's a freelance journalist. He's written this article in the Christian Research Journal called Suffer the Children, What's Wrong with Gay Adoption. You're listening to Issues Etc., and I'm Todd Wilkin. Greg, when you just mentioned, putting into the hands of these individuals and sometimes couples, gay couples, our society's children, should one worry about the issue of pedophilia?
I think that's a very good point, and here one's got to be careful, obviously from a legal point of view, but the situation basically stands as follows. A number of significant psychiatric bodies have made official statements that there's no significant link between homosexuality and pedophilia, which should automatically make us think, well, everything's okay. But
we'll try and get Greg back here. Oh, Greg, he's still there? We are connecting with him from South Africa, so the phone line may not be as dependable as it could be, given the tremendous distance between me and Greg. We'll get him back here on the line and continue our conversation here in just a moment on issues, etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Coming up in about 10 minutes on the program, Dr. James Lamb of Lutherans for Life joins us. We're going to talk about two issues. First of all, you may not know this about Dr. Lamb, but he suffers from multiple sclerosis. And one must wonder, as a victim of multiple sclerosis, how does he hold the position against embryonic stem cell research? There's so many emotional appeals in the media from victims of various diseases like this for embryonic stem cell research. We'll find out why Dr. James Lamb opposes it, and we'll talk a bit about the results from the autopsy of Terry Schindler Schiavo. Greg is back with us here. Greg, let's talk a bit, if we could. You were in the middle of talking about pedophilia.
Yes,
and
that's right.
We were cut off just about the time where you were talking about what we know about the relationship between homosexuality and pedophilia.
Yes. Well, I, just going to my next point, I refer to a study by two sociologists called Stacey and Biblars, Judith Stacey and Timothy Biblars. They did a study, and I think it was a 2001 issue of the American Sociological Review, where they actually reviewed a number of studies that had been conducted of children who had been adopted into gay households. And the interesting find that they made was that there were political... political correctness had been taken into account in a number of these of these studies, and that facts that might misrepresent the gay subculture had actually been hidden and not been revealed. And in fact, Stacey said that it's time to look at this issue with eyes wide open, and that there are problems in gay households. Children do not grow up the same as in straight households, and they made the statement that researchers have shied away from acknowledging those problems for fear that it would inflame homophobia. So, in other words, for reasons of political correctness, these problems with gay adoption households have in fact been glossed over and been hidden from general view. And when we adding that to the whole problem, we look at the alarming number of quotes and references in the gay subculture and in gay literature to paedophilia, sometimes unashamed references to child molestation. It's really got to concern us quite deeply. First of all, just going back to the two studies that I went to earlier, the Bell and Weinberg study, 25% of the gay respondents admitted to having molested underage youths, and in the Gay Report, the Allen and Young study, I think it was 23% admitted to having molested underage youths. So we've really got a significant problem there. Just going through some of the quotes that I gave in the actual article, there were quotes from the 1990 issue of the Journal of Homosexuality. Now, the Journal of Homosexuality is the official academic wing of homosexual issues. Now, first of all, the interesting thing is that it's actually edited by somebody called John DeCecco, who, curiously enough, also sits on the editorial board of PIDECA. Now, PIDECA is another journal. It's a paedophilia advocacy journal. It's a journal that tries to make out that paedophilia is okay. So first we've got John DeCecco, who sits on the editorial board of both magazines. Now, in 1990, the Journal of Homosexuality ran an issue on the matter of paedophilia. And the interesting quotes that came out of that included from one article, which says that, quote, "the threat to make all paedophile acts punishable by law can barely be labeled civilized. It implies discrimination and persecution of a minority and should be abolished."
Greg Rogers is our guest. He's a freelance journalist and author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled "Suffer the Children, What's Wrong with Gay Adoption?" Having a little trouble with our connection to South Africa. And as time permits here, going into this break, if there's enough time, we'll try to get Greg back here to conclude our conversation. Maybe bump Dr. Lamb back a little bit just for a few minutes so we can let Greg finish up with a final question. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 2727. After we conclude our conversation with Greg and with Dr. James Lamb in the first hour of the program, we will be talking about a subject I brought up yesterday for Open Lines. We didn't get to it. I mentioned it. Picking up on our visit to Willow Creek that we had last week on our Issues Etc. Reformation tour, going in, seeing the stage set for what will be probably at least a preacher and a praise band at Willow Creek, I was just wondering, should the choir, should the praise band be up front in the church? Now, everyone's probably got an opinion on this. I want to hear from you in the second hour of the program, your answer to that question. Should the choir or the praise band be up front in church? Greg is back. Greg, one last question. We only have a few minutes here. Is the jury still out, since gay adoption is a relatively new subject, is the jury still out on the long-term results of children being raised in gay households? We've only got 2 minutes here, no more.
Well, very much so, yes. The jury is very much still out. I refer to one study which was done a couple of years ago by two researchers called Lern and Nagai, who basically do another survey of all the gay adoption studies conducted to date, and first of all indicate that the studies actually prove nothing. The studies are flawed. They should not be used as any basis for legal court decisions. And secondly, of course, there's a very good point about long-term results on children raised in gay households. No, we very simply don't have that sort of evidence as well at all. In fact, there's a quote from the 1985 president of the American Psychiatric Association, who said that the data is still coming in on the whole question of gay issues, and we shouldn't be rushing to form a conclusion on that. And so I think as regards that matter, the jury is very much out, and we can't jump to conclusions. I refer, for example, to the parallel issue of cloning. A lot of people are very shy of cloning. More so because we don't have the data. We don't have the data we need at this stage. And wisely, people are saying, well, let's step back and let's just wait and see. And 20, 30 years' time, maybe we'll have the data. Maybe we can make a decision then. But no, because of political correctness, the issue of gay adoption is being rushed through now. And the tragedy is that it's just risking so much damage on our children. And what one's got to ask the question of where society is going and if we as a society really want to take our children down this road.
Greg Rogers is a freelance journalist. He is author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Suffer the Children, What's Wrong with Gay Adoption? It serves as a great summary for those of you who want to know what the research does say at this point about children in gay households. And he joined us live from South Africa. Greg, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much.
When we come back from this break, a regular guest, Dr. James Lamb, is going to join us. Of course, top of mind right now today, you're hearing it on the news and perhaps seeing it, reading it in the newspaper as well. The autopsy of Terry Schindler Schiavo, its results, such as they are, have been released. We'll talk about what those results are and what they mean, at least retrospectively, on that highly controversial case of Terry Schindler Schiavo. Some might say, hey, look, it all seems to have run in favor of Michael Schiavo, and maybe he did the right thing. We'll get Dr. Lamb's response to that when we come back from this break.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Listen to this prayer from Martin Luther. Dear Lord, you know that I cannot come before you on account of my own self, my presumption, my worthiness. I would not even know how I might begin to pray. Nevertheless, I do come before you because you have commanded it, and you earnestly encourage that we should call upon you. That is but one part of but one prayer in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, a Lutheran Book of Prayer. The book is $8.99 plus shipping and handling. For this devotional resource, visit either of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores in the St. Louis area, one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, a Lutheran Book of Prayer. Or for more information on the book, visit our website, issuesetc.org. On the homepage, you'll find a Lutheran Book of Prayer.
What's your view of Christians living in the Arab world? This Global Minute lets you in on some welcome news. A well-respected Arab church in the Middle East is planning to send out their own summer team to reach Arabs living in the United States. Meanwhile, there's another church located in the North African country of Algeria that's planning to send out Christians to other parts of the Arab world. Here's another trend. As many as 4 to 5 dozen new churches are emerging in Iraq. These encouraging updates are being followed quietly, since publicity could endanger the lives of the people involved. But despite barriers, God's Spirit is moving, and more people in the Muslim world are hearing about Christ. Pray for Christians to have courage and persistence as they live out their faith in tough circumstances. God honors prayer for successful outreaches around the world. Get behind Christians in prayer with information from the website missionvisionnetwork.org. missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. In Homer's Odyssey, the giant Cyclops captures the hero Odysseus. When Odysseus escapes by blinding Cyclops, the giant asks, "What's your name?" Wily Odysseus answers, "No one." Cyclops, blinded and alone, calls out for help. But when his neighbors ask who has harmed him, he answers, "No one." So they went back to do whatever neighbors of Cyclops do, and the giant went back into his cave, alone and blinded. To many of us, Michael Jackson is a no one, the likes of whom we have never known in our normal lives. And he's gone back into his Neverland, a place few of us would want to inhabit. By contrast, how blessed are you to know the names you know, to know your family, to know your friends, to be one among them. You are not a no one, defined by your media status as a pop giant. And how blessed you are to have a home that's real, not a Neverland made up out of your fantasies, not a cave where you hurt alone, but a place where real love lives. How blessed are you when, as they say, you are comfortable in your own skin. Genesis 32, verse 10, "I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast shown unto thy servant." How blessed by God you are, a real person, and you live a real life.
There's something new happening every day on Worldwide KFUO. You'll find live streaming audio, your favorite programs on demand, and now we're podcasting several programs for automatic download to your portable listening devices. You'll also find discussion forums, contact information, and a secure way to donate online to your favorite ministry, AM 850 KFUO. So join us daily on Worldwide KFUO at www.kfuo.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. James Lamb is a regular guest here on the program and executive director of Lutherans for Life based in Nevada, Iowa. He joins us for the next 25 minutes to talk about two things. We're going to begin with the thing you're hearing about on the news, and that is the autopsy of Terry Schindler-Schiavo. The results are in, and what this means. Does it mean that all of those of us who opposed the dehydration and starvation of Terry Schindler-Schiavo should shut up because Michael Schiavo was right all along to do what he did? We'll talk about that. And Dr. James Lamb suffers from multiple sclerosis. We're going to talk about victims of MS and other diseases and their opposition or support for embryonic stem cell research. Dr. James Lamb, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
First of all, this news about Terry Schindler-Schiavo's autopsy, the results in a nutshell are that there was no trauma to her body indicating abuse. Mm-hmm. That she died, of course, of dehydration. That was expected. And that her brain damage was profound and irreversible, in the words of the coroner. Someone might say, well, there you go. Michael Schiavo did the right thing. She was never going to recover. He didn't beat her. And he didn't starve her to death. She died of dehydration. How would you respond to all of that?
Well, I don't think there wasn't a lot in the autopsy that the autopsy report that surprised me. I think we knew she was severely brain damaged, and the report showed that. The report showed that the brain damage was undoubtedly irreversible, and there were some, including her parents, who thought maybe with therapy she she could regain some of that. And the autopsy tended to indicate probably not so. But it showed that she wasn't abused by her husband. But those things, I believe, are not relevant to the moral problems of this case. I think the two key things here, one you've already mentioned, the cause of her death was dehydration. And generally, that's the cause of death. When you take somebody's food and water away, they dehydrate to death before they starve to death. And so we know the cause of her death. The cause of her death wasn't brain atrophy. The cause of her death wasn't her severe brain damage. The cause of the death was the removal of her water. And then the other key factor in the autopsy, I believe, is that the doctor indicated that Terry Schiavo could have lived for another decade, barring any kind of problems with infections and so on. That tells us that Terry Schiavo was not dying at the time her feeding tube was removed, and that indeed the removal of the feeding tube was the cause of her death. So that's the moral issue. That's the critical issue for us as Christians. It is not trying to judge the value of someone's life based on what they can do or not do. The critical issue was that she wasn't dying, and we don't have the right to kill someone who's not, we don't have the right to kill someone under any circumstances, and that is what happened in the Schiavo case. The intention might have been good to relieve her suffering, but the point is good intentions don't allow us to make decisions about ending someone's life.
One other question on that, Dr. Lamb. Someone might focus in on the fact that her brain damage, at least according to the autopsy, appeared to be irreversible. And there was a lot of rhetoric that, well, if we give Terry some extra time, maybe she can do this and maybe she can recover to this certain degree. No one was talking about a full recovery, but a little bit. But even if she, even since now the autopsy says she wouldn't have made any significant recovery during, say, the last decade of her life, does that make any difference at all?
I don't believe it makes any difference. Because we are placing ourselves in a position where we're deciding the value. We were trying to decide the value of Terry's life based upon the condition of her health, the condition of her brain. And as Christians, that's not how we look at what gives life value. God is the one who gives life value. And we make our God really small if we say somehow he can't give value, meaning, and purpose to someone like Terry Schiavo, that he can't use her for good, that he can't use her to accomplish his will through her.
You have even written in an article in the latest LifeDate newsletter that God was hiding in the life of Terry Schiavo, and he hides in the lives of those like her who have severe disabilities, waiting to be glorified. What do you mean by that?
Well, that article, part of that article was based on Paul's words, where he says to the Philippians that, you know, he desires to depart and be with Christ. That would be far better, and certainly that's true. But on the other hand, he realizes that it may be God's will that he remain, and for the good of the Philippians and for the good of others. And so Paul's conclusion is that whether he lives or he dies, he wants Christ to be exalted in his body, and that Christ will indeed be exalted. And the verb there in the passage is passive, and so it's not Paul who's going to be exalting Christ, but Christ is going to be exalted in Paul whether he lives or he dies. And so meaning and purpose for Paul's life flows from what Christ would do and continue to do in Paul's life, or what Christ would do in Paul's death. Christ is the one who is exalted and glorified. And when we're faced with situations like Terry Schiavo, we minimize and belittle the power of God when we say he can't be exalted because the person can't do anything. God is the one who glorifies himself in these kinds of situations by what he is able to accomplish and what he is able to do. Another example is in John 9, the man who was born blind. And we look at that situation, and certainly the parents probably questioned why he was born blind, friends and relatives, you know, why, what a tragedy. And yet the scripture tells us exactly why he was born blind. He was born blind so that Jesus could heal him. He was born blind so that the works of God might be seen in and through him. He was born blind to eventually, through his blindness, give glory to God. So it's God who glorifies himself in these situations, and we simply minimize his power when we think that we can make the decision about when a life has no more value or no more purpose.
Dr. Lamb, I did not know until I read a letter to the editor that you wrote late last month that you suffer from multiple sclerosis, MS.
Yes, well, I prefer to say I have MS rather than that I suffer.
Okay, sure. So you have MS, and that was somewhat surprising to me personally, but also makes me curious. What does that mean? What does that disease mean in terms of a prognosis for someone like you when you have it?
Well, first of all, we haven't made a big deal of it until recently, and we're still not trying to make a big deal of it, but it just seemed relevant in light of especially embryonic stem cell research and all the promises held out for that. And MS is one of those diseases that may one day find a cure because of stem cell research. In fact, the MS, National MS Society, is funding research into adult stem cells, not embryonic stem cells, for a possible cure of MS, and there's been some success. But what happens to MS folks like myself is the myelin, the sheath that encircles and protects the nerves, that begins to break down. Your own immune system attacks it. And when those myelin sheath cells are destroyed, they don't grow back. And so you end up with a damaged nerve area, and impulses may not travel at all, or they may travel irregularly. So I have what is called recurring remitting MS, meaning my symptoms come and go. And it's a funny disease. You don't know from one day to the next what symptoms you might have. Right now, my symptoms are pretty much gone. I have some weakness in my right arm and right hand. Fatigue is a major problem with most MS people. And so sometimes by the end of the day, I'm kind of worn out. I have only had two major exacerbations where I actually had to cancel speaking engagements, but I was diagnosed in 1999, so two cancellations during that whole time is pretty good. A prognosis is that recurring remitting MS, that may be it for me. This may be as bad as it gets for me the rest of my life. Or it can change into progressive MS, and that is where the damage is done, and you don't have a relapse or regain use of an arm or hand and so on. And then that eventually leads to death.
I believe a second cousin who suffers from, it sounds like, exactly the kind of MS that you have, Dr. Lamb. Sometimes she's, and this has been now 20 years, I think, since she was diagnosed. Sometimes she's on her feet, moving about very well. And then there are times when she's so weak, she's in a wheelchair. And you never know from day to day what the how the symptoms will present themselves.
Now, it's very true. I just feel that I've been blessed because of the lack of severity of my symptoms up to this point. And now just it seems appropriate to let folks know that there are people like me out there who have a chronic illness who are opposed to embryonic stem cell research because, for one of the reasons, all of that focus is taking focus away from research that's actually producing some results in treating not only MS but other neurological diseases, and that's the use of adult stem cell therapy that's already being used clinically in treating human beings. And embryonic stem cells have yet to be used clinically to treat human beings.
We're talking with Dr. James Lamb, Executive Director of Lutherans for Life, based in Nevada, Iowa, about whether or not people with MS should support embryonic stem cell research. Dr. Lamb, you've said already, you said it in your letter to the editor, that you oppose embryonic stem cell research. You say the first reason is that it is really the pinnacle of selfishness, you say, to say that just because you have this disease, you have the right to demand the sacrifice of other human beings to provide a potential cure for yourself. Make the case about the whole human being issue there, because some people would say, no, it's a clump of cells we're talking about, not a human being in embryonic stem cell research.
Human life begins at the moment of conception, and there are all kinds of people who will roll their eyes and raise their eyebrows when you say that, but that's simply a fact of embryology. I think I've said it before in your program, but it's worth saying again to help people understand that, you know, medical textbooks in this country, embryology textbooks that our doctors use to train in this area, state book after book that the moment sperm and egg come together and the moment that genetic material is exchanged, you have the beginning of a new human life, a new human being. And I believe that Scripture affirms that, although Scripture is not an embryology textbook, it certainly affirms in passages that life begins at the moment of conception. One quick example, many of us know the story of Mary. The angel came to her and announced that the Holy Spirit would overshadow her and she would conceive in her womb. And that is the moment when Jesus was conceived within her. And immediately after that, Luke writes, she went to visit Elizabeth. And that journey, Elizabeth would have lived near Jerusalem because her husband was a priest. Mary was at Nazareth, so maybe 100 miles, 5, 6, 7 days of travel. How big would Jesus be? He would be about the size of the blastocyst that we want to destroy for stem cells. And yet, John the Baptist, who is inside Elizabeth's womb, reacts to the presence of Jesus, who's just this little dot. And Elizabeth herself, you know, says, "Who am I that the mother of my Lord?" She doesn't say Mary's going to be the mother of her Lord, but Mary, at that moment, right there, is the mother of her Lord. And so both the reaction of John and the words of Elizabeth indicate that even as a little blastocyst, Jesus was Jesus at that very moment. So human life begins at the moment of conception. Therefore, 5 days later, when embryonic stem cells are taken, those cells are taken from a living, growing, developing human being. We were all little blastocysts at one time in the continuum of our life. And so I make no distinction between, say, killing my neighbor in order to somehow treat my disease. That would not be morally acceptable to anyone, I don't believe, and killing a small, tiny, little human embryo in order to treat my disease.
Dr. Lamb, how do you react to those who say that embryonic stem cell research is a life-affirming course because it is said to hold so much promise for curing all sorts of disease?
Well, first of all, that's all we have so far, a lot of promise. But someday, that promise may be a reality. Someday, embryonic stem cells may be used. That cannot be said to be life-affirming, even though it may be found that embryonic stem cells may cure diseases and thus help cure people and prolong life. It cannot be said to be life-affirming when life is purposefully destroyed in order to make that happen. That is not life-affirming. That devalues human life at that stage of development. And as many have said, when you devalue life at one stage, you devalue life at all stages.
Dr. Lamb, you also ask rhetorically at the end of your letter to the editor, you say to all editors, congressmen, and others pushing for embryonic stem cell research, why are you ignoring me and others like me? Don't you want cures for devastating diseases like mine? Why do you ask these questions?
Well, it was kind of a ploy, actually, because the rhetoric is that those of us who are pro-life, those of us who oppose embryonic stem cell research, we're the ones that lack compassion. We're the ones that are insensitive to those with chronic and debilitating diseases because we don't want to push for embryonic stem cell research. And I was trying to turn the tables on that because I believe it's true. The reality is all the push for embryonic stem cell research and trying to get federal funds for that can detract from research that is proving successful in treating diseases like the one I have. So, you know, you have to ask the question, who's being compassionate here and who isn't being compassionate?
The facts on embryonic stem cell research are a matter of simple biology, as you have pointed out. We're talking about the destruction of a human person.
Yes.
The facts about how far adult stem cell research has already gone are also readily available to anyone who wants to access them. Greater success in adult stem cell research that involves no killing, no taking of human life, than there is in embryonic stem cell research. So why is it that there is so much push in the media, so much push from editorial boards of major newspapers, so much push from people, our lawmakers, for pursuing the less successful of these two courses and the morally objectionable alternative between these two?
Well, there's practical reasons. I asked a scientist that, Dr. David Prentice, who has spoken for Lutherans for Life conferences a number of times, and I've heard him speak at other conferences, and I asked him that as a scientist, and this is related to your question, doesn't directly answer it, I'll get there in a second, but scientists keep pushing for these things because they're locked into this model. It's how the research began, and scientists, if it can be done, they want to do it, and they want to be the first. It's the old axiom of publish or perish, and they want to be the first to publish a cure of human disease in this area of embryonic stem cell research, and they're locked into that model. And scientific community has a lot of influence, it appears, on the media, and there's so much promise for cure that the media buys into this, as do the politicians. But I think there's also a subtle reason out there why there's so much push here on these issues. And I simply call it the abortion mentality. If the news media, if politicians who are in favor of abortion somehow indicate that there might be something morally wrong with destroying a tiny human being at 5 days of development, then what in the world are we going to say about destroying human beings, you know, seconds before they're fully born through things like partial birth abortion? So I see it as kind of a defense mechanism, if you would, in order to protect abortion on demand in this country, we can't any way indicate that there's something morally wrong with destroying a tiny little embryo.
Dr. Lamb, coming up in November here in St. Louis, Lutherans for Life is going to be having its national conference, and you will be having on the first day of that conference a regular guest here on this program, Wesley Smith, from the Discovery Institute, as the keynote speaker. What can those who attend this Lutherans for Life conference, national conference in St. Louis, expect to hear, and what's planned for that weekend?
Well, there's Wesley Smith is kind of a hinge in that whole weekend. There's on Friday of that weekend, in November 11th, there's going to be a bioethics conference that's co-sponsored by the Concordia Bioethics Institute and the LCMS Life Ministries and Lutherans for Life. And so we're going to have top speakers, Nigel Cameron and others, focusing in on bioethics and these issues. And then Wesley Smith, who is knowledgeable on these bioethic issues as well as end-of-life issues, he's going to keynote there Friday evening and kind of act as a hinge, because our conference for Saturday and Sunday will be focusing upon end-of-life issues. And we're using the phrase from the hymn, "Abide with me in life and death, O Lord, abide with me." So Wesley Smith will be kind of a transition. And then Wesley, as well as yourself, Pastor Wilkin, will be giving us some plenary addresses on the next day. So, and I think it's a great tie-in. We talk about life at the very, very beginning stages and the things that are going on that devalue that life. That has led us to the devaluing of life in cases like Terri Schiavo, where this whole discussion began.
We're going to be talking more about that in future conversations with Dr. James Lamb. Folks, you can check out the website for Lutherans for Life. Go first to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for James Lamb and Lutherans for Life under the links section, or you can call them toll-free, 1-888-364-LIFE, for their free Life Day newsletter. For more information on their national conference here in St. Louis, November 11th, 12th, and 13th, 1-888-364-LIFE. Dr. Lamb, thanks for being our guest.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Dr. James Lamb is Executive Director of Lutherans for Life, based in Nevada, Iowa. When we come back from this break, should the choir or the praise band be up front in church? I want your answer to that question with open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.